It is April 18, 2002, and we're going to be talking about communal experiences about Koinonia.
Koinonia and Jubilee Partners.
Jubilee Partners. I guess for openers, could you just kind of give us a little bit of time and place? When did you start out at Koinonia, say?
Okay. You probably already have background on Koinonia, the
sure.
fact that it started in 1942 and so on. Clarence Jordan was the primary personality in the forming of that, along with his wife Florence and Martin and Mabel England. Florence was the only person still there when my wife Carolyn and I arrived in 1970. Maybe I should say that we had heard about Koinonia ourselves for the first time while I was the associate director of the Peace Corps in Korea, and a good friend of mine, LaDon Sheets, began to send me these long reel-to-reel tapes over to Korea about this extraordinary man. He'd discovered Clarence Jordan, and he would send tapes of Clarence's workshops and sermons and so on, and that really caught my attention. So that we ended up coming to Koinonia then in the summer of 1970. However, we never met Clarence because he died in October of 69. So what we met instead was a group of, a pretty amazing group of people. Most of them would be modest and say, oh no, nothing amazing about us, but I think I've never run into a collection of people with more enthusiasm for what they were about, and yet they were all over the spectrum, all over the map in terms of personal style and intentions about what they were there for. One still probably the best known who was there when we got there is still the head of Habitat for Humanity, Mellard Fuller.
He's still at Koinonia?
No, he's in Americas, 8 miles away from Koinonia.
Oh.
And that's where the headquarters of Habitat are located now. But when we got there, Mellard was the director of Koinonia when we came in 1970. And his wife, Linda, and we became very good friends immediately. There was another man there, LaDon Sheets. Just to give you a little bit of a sprinkling of the kinds of people that were there, LaDon had been the man who had been sending me these tapes and who was the one who attracted me then to Georgia in the first place. I might just say parenthetically, hours before I left on this trip 2 days ago, I got word that LaDon is extremely ill with pancreatic cancer. One of my closest friends in my whole life, most influential. I have not been able to contact him yet by telephone because he's so weak, but he's in Lubbock, Texas right now in the hospital. But LaDon had just resigned from IBM, one of their top and rapidly rising young executives in IBM. He had resigned from IBM, I think, in December or January. December it was of 69, just after Clarence died, packed up, gave away everything and moved to Koinonia. Gave away everything except his Firebird sports car. He drove it down. It was a little incongruous, parked out there in this simple living place, but it was wrecked by a volunteer before long, so they got rid of that problem. There was an Irish Catholic priest. He had become an Episcopal priest, married a woman from Alabama and moved there, who was quite a character, who had been an actor, a professional actor, as one of his careers back in United Kingdom. And just a wide range of people like this. When we got there in that summer of 70, there were around 100 people packed into all of these ramshackled old buildings, which had themselves, the buildings had all survived some decades by that time of gunshots and dynamiting and attacks by the KKK and all the rest. Bullet holes were all around, still in very clear evidence and so on. So we moved into that, and it blew my mind. I had lived all over the world. I had had a lot of experiences already, but nothing quite like this. Mm-hmm. And I certainly was not used to being part of a subversive group like this, you know, people like this who were stepping out of the mainstream, especially highly talented, highly motivated people like Millard and LaDon and the others. So we stayed there. My wife, very reluctantly at first, she came from a Southern Baptist background in Texas, Hawaii, grew up as the daughter of a Hawaiian educator and missionary. I had also come out of Texas, but had left organized religion for a while, even called myself an atheist for a couple of years, and decided that wasn't really what I was, but gradually rediscovered then some what felt authentic for me in my own Christian roots, and Koinonia appealed to me as a place to continue to pursue that. We came there, and I think the thing that caused us to stay, and in all honesty, I have to say it caused me to stay, and Carolyn, as a non-liberated wife at that stage, was saying, okay, Don, you're the husband, you know, whatever you say, I'll stay. She's not like that today. Yeah. I don't want her to be like that. We both progressed quite a bit. But in those days, what caused me to want to stay was that I sensed here in the early 70s a group of people who were in a very real sense converging or causing to converge in their own lives and thinking some of the spirit of the 60s, the exploratory spirit that led to so many communes and so many experiments of all types and jumping the traces of all types of conventions and mores in the secular dimensions of the movement of the 60s, and of course the civil rights movement and Kennedy's assassination and all of that turmoil, the Cold War, it's hard to even recreate a lot of that atmosphere unless I go back and see something like Eyes on the Prize, the series about the civil rights movement and things like that. Again, oh my goodness, I remember what a tumultuous time it was. People who had been searching in that, and in most cases had failed to find anything that really, really satisfied them, seemed to gravitate toward Koinonia if they also had a something of a spiritual dimension to their search, a Christian spiritual dimension, not just generalized. In a few cases generalized, but mostly it was people with some fairly strong Christian roots somehow, but very dissatisfied with the way they saw Christianity being lived out in their churches and communities that they had come from. Koinonia offered a place to explore alternatives to that and to try to put that faith into action in a way that felt more authentic for them. Well, we built low-cost housing. Millard put me in charge almost immediately of the construction of low-cost houses for local people, which at that time meant entirely for low-income African-American families, because none of the white families in the area wanted anything to do with Koinonia, none of the poor families at least. So we were building houses for those people. We built, under my leadership, probably 50 or 75 such houses, and then Habitat for Humanity grew out of that in 1976. Millard and I did the brainstorming that really caused things to begin to fall together into pattern, the pattern that emerged as Habitat for Humanity. And I actually, Millard and Linda went to Zaire in January of 1972. I followed a year later and spent the month of January of 73 in Zaire with them, helping to design and survey what became the first official Habitat project then, in Bandaka, Zaire. In 79, we started Jubilee Partners. a group of us, three families, the Karras family, Ryan and Karen Karras, the Weir family, Ed and Mary Ruth Weir, and their children, and Carolyn and I and our children, six adults and six children. After 2 years of brainstorming and praying and researching at Koinonia about where a new community should be and what its focus should be and all of those kinds of things, by the whole Koinonia community, this was all undertaken as a project of Koinonia. It was not a, you know, a negative split or something like that, but it was seen as a way of expanding what we were already doing at Koinonia. After 2 years of that, then the six adults and six children moved up to Northeast Georgia to Comer and Madison County, bought 260 acres of land with Koinonia's underwriting our loan, and started building our first house while we were all living in tents. Thinking that we had brainstormed our way through to a pretty clear pattern of what we were going to be doing as a community, and yet it was an amazing experience. The very week that Carolyn and I moved up to the new Jubilee property and pitched our tent and moved there permanently with our kids, that very week there was a cover story in Newsweek magazine about the agony of the boat people, the Vietnamese boat people. And that article, 17-page article, made such an impact on me. I still remember the front page, the picture on the front page of this boatload, open boat full of Vietnamese refugees. Made such an impact. I read it through twice and sat down and wrote up a proposal for the other Jubilee people, which they all read, and within an hour, everybody was sitting and talking enthusiastically about making this into an orientation center, a reception center for refugees, the boat people and others from around the world. We had a small board of directors. We were organized as a 501c3 tax-exempt organization with a board. Those directors heard our ideas and our enthusiasm and immediately confirmed it, approved it as a board. And we set out to build enough houses and get everything in place in the next 12 months to be able to welcome refugees 12 months later. I think it actually took us about 14 before the first refugees actually got there. You say, incidentally, at that point we got a lesson in community, well, at least in Jubilee Partners, economics. We had $26,000 to our names. We had no jobs. We had never sent out a newsletter, with the exception of one that we had sent out to the Koinonia mailing list, one-time-only permission from Koinonia. And we had sent 9,000 letters out, 9,500 to Habitat for Humanity. That was when Habitat had 9,500 names on their mailing list. Now they have over 2 million. But we got a one-time use of their mailing list. And out of all of that had come, together with other names that we had put together from personal lists, about 2,000 names that became our initial mailing list. It's grown to maybe 12,000 now. And we sent this mailing out then to that list of people saying, we have no money, not nearly enough even to build our first house, let alone support the community and launch this kind of venture. But we feel that we really are called to help homeless people from around the world. That was the kind of vision that inspired us from the beginning, from Jesus' first sermon out of Isaiah, about taking in the homeless and clothing the naked and working for peace and justice and those kinds of themes. It was very much the center of what motivated us. And I estimated before we sent that newsletter out that in the next 12 months we would need to raise $131,000. That was my best estimate of what the houses would cost and the refugees buildings and that sort of thing. And that if I forget how many, 40,000-50,000 person hours of labor I estimated it would take to get all this ready. A year or two ago, I found in my old files some notes about that, and then I found a compilation of the donations that came in over the next 12 months, It came to $131,250.
Wow.
Just barely skimmed over that. And in fact, we did. In fact, my estimate was right on.
Boy.
As far as hours, we didn't keep a record of how many hours we were working. As many as we could stand on our feet, 6.5 days a week, most of that year. We just were exhausted most of the time. And lots of visitors began to come and help us. But we finished the cabin for the first refugees 12 hours before they arrived. So it came out pretty close, but it came out. The first refugees turned out then, and they arrived in September of 1980, and they were boat people from Cuba instead of Vietnam, because under President Carter at that time, the Marialetas, so-called, had begun to come up in large numbers to Florida. And the Methodist Church called and said, we've heard about your plans and your facilities, will you work with us? And we said yes, and so we hosted about 40 of the Cubans, 39 I think. Then the boat people from Vietnam began to come. We hosted maybe 60 of them initially, and I think a similar number of Laotians, 100 Cambodians in about 1981. Then we shifted over to a maverick kind of program for the next 8 years, cooperating very closely with Church World Service, but getting no cooperation from the U.S. government at all, working with the Latin American, Central American refugees from El Salvador, mostly, Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua. And we ran a bus, we bought a bus and ran it back and forth to South Texas, 60 round trips, bringing over 1,300 Central Americans through Jubilee, getting a lot of cooperation from the Canadian government. They would send their consul to Jubilee each time we brought another group, interviewed the people, and accepted virtually all of them into Canada. So those people avoided deportation. They were carefully selected as the ones most likely to be killed if they went back. At one point, we were able to accept only about 4% of all the applicants in the Rio Grande Valley who were asking to come. So we helped 1,300 people become Canadians instead of go back to Central America, and many of them, I'm sure, would have died. Then we shifted to back to Vietnamese and other Southeast Asians, Middle Easterners, a few. The war in Yugoslavia came along. We hosted over 500 Bosnian Muslims. For the past couple of years, we've had a wide variety of people, but mostly Africans. Including 40 of the so-called lost boys of Sudan, young men who have been orphans wandering in the wilderness for 15 years since their homes were bombed and their families killed in 1987. 3,600 of those were admitted to the U.S. this past year, and 40 of the men came through Jubilee, and one girl, younger sister that made it through our program. And so we've had, up to this point, the total comes to, I think, just under 2,500 refugees that have come through Jubilee from more than 30 different countries all over the world, everywhere around the world. That has defined our community ethos, or our community central identity, and the glue that helps to hold together our lives day to day in a way that I cannot imagine any other ministry ever having done. It has given us a constant international focus, cross-cultural, a different understanding very often of U.S. policies and economic involvement in crises around the world. It has involved us directly in dozens of trips and projects, relief projects, sometimes protests against U.S. policy, many, many other, what would appear to a lot of people to be extracurricular activities. We see it as all very much woven into this fabric of working for peace and justice in this world as a Christian community. And it's just been nonstop. In fact, the big problem is always how to choose between the many, many things that stand before us that tempt us to get involved. Do we have enough energy? Is this the right time to do that? Along the way, well, maybe I should drop back and say one other thing related to that too, just a personal note. I've been, my wife and I now, Carolyn and I, after 32 years of living at Koinonia and Jubilee, I feel quite sure we'd be in the top one percentile of intentional community residents in terms of longevity.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very few last more than a year or two or 5 years.
Except for the Hutterites.
The Hutterites and the traditional churches, Hutterites especially, would be the exception to that. But of the communities that have sprung up over the past century, almost none of them last more than a few years as a whole, and the individuals usually drop out much faster. At 32 years, we're old-timers in the community movement, and yet, and maybe this is not a contrast, I mean, maybe there's a more logical connection. It's not something to be amazed at, but something that explains our longevity. We've never been very interested in community. Carolyn and I, we don't go to community conferences. On very rare occasions have we ever gone to conferences that have just focused on living in community. I think I've been to one or two in 32 years. One at Twin Oaks one time, was a strange kind of conference that we went to. And I went there mostly because I had been offered a chance to speak about the arms race. And so I did that at Twin Oaks. And it caused people to get pretty uptight in a hurry. But in the end, I think it worked out all right. And I went to another conference that was sponsored by Sojourners one time. The main focus was on community. But even then, all of our friends in community were joining the, you may be familiar with that broader umbrella organization, Community of Communities, they called it for a while. Jubilee never did join that. I think we sent a representative to one or two of their meetings. I never went to one, other than this one initial meeting because of my friendship with Jim Wallace and the others at Sojourners. Because for me personally, and I'm not critiquing intentional communities or people who live in them so much as I'm just trying to be objective about my own motivations, community has been always for me a means to an end, not an end in itself. The end, if I could define it, has more to do with putting my faith into action in a very troubled world to promote peace and understanding and justice and mercy in this world. And I find community to be a very good platform from which to do that, a very good vehicle for that kind of work. Pragmatically, it makes a lot of sense to, if you can find a group of like-minded people, more or less like-minded people, who never agree totally on anything, who are all interested in doing that kind of work, to do it together in a cooperative way, is far more economically feasible and efficient than doing it as a lot of Lone Rangers. And it has made possible many things for us as a community that would never have been possible for us, even if we had been a bunch of well-funded individuals. I'm convinced of that, and that's why I'm still there 32 years later and have no expectations of leaving. Right now, I'd say the odds are I'll die there, and Carolyn feels the same way. I have seen many people infatuated by community per se. Who have come into community with that as their chief motivation. I can't think of one that has in fact stayed a long time, because once the novelty wears off and the dish lists begin to be more, you know, on their minds, who's going to cook tonight, who has to entertain this next group of visitors that's coming through up the driveway right now, if that's what, and the mechanics of setting that up, if that's what community is to them, then they learn all they really want to know about that in a year or two, and usually say, okay, it's time now, I'm ready for a new adventure, and we'll move on. But those of us who are there because we really like what you can do through community life, I think we're the ones that stay long. So that's been true for me, at least. At Jubilee, we right now have 14 resident partners. That's our name for the adult year-round residence. It is our home. We have no plans to move elsewhere. We used to call them permanent residents, and we realized that that was a misnomer, that nobody was permanent. They couldn't be sure if they were, at least, and so we call them resident partners. Those 14 resident partners have two parents who are living with us also, who are very similar to being resident partners. They don't come to all the meetings, but they're full, very welcome. That's their home also. They live and share a house with one of the resident partner couples. And I believe we have 12 children right now, school kids, who are living still at Jubilee, who have not gone off to college mm-hmm. or moved on. I don't know how many others we've had. My wife and I have two children who've long since gone through college. No, they haven't gone through college. They're both in graduate school right now for one master's degree after another. But they are, our son is married and has a one-year-old daughter. And our daughter is graduating this weekend, this coming weekend, from Eastern Mennonite University with her master's. And our son is working on his second master's right now at University of Cincinnati. I'd say there are probably six or eight such children who grew up at Jubilee who are now, in most cases, graduates. Most were university graduates, and most were, in fact, were and are excellent students. I think our kids have won somewhere 10 to 20 times their fair share of scholarships and special academic recognitions. They've been the salutatorians and the valedictorians. I believe because they grew up in community, or at least it's clear to all the local school people, for instance, they constantly comment on it, that a Jubilee student, a Jubilee kid, stands out. Even the ones that are not really particularly gifted intellectually, they are immersed in a stream of cultural experiences and visitors from all over the world. And we have no television. That's been a fundamental at Jubilee. Was not at Koinonia, but we decided to try community without television, and we have never seen any reason to change that. We show a VCR, a video once in a while, three or four times a year maybe. We just don't have time for it. And I think that's why our kids are, in general, much more active rather than passive intellectually. They tend to write little plays and put them on and perform and learn musical instruments and play constantly and invent everything from building tree houses to just constantly doing things like that in a way that I think makes them much more lively people intellectually, and that shows up in their school records among other things. We have been a stable. Well, and describing the population, let me add one more thing that we have also on our staff at Jubilee, typically about 10 to 12 adult volunteers who come to us for terms similar to a university term, a spring, summer, or fall term, deliberately coinciding with academic terms, so it makes it easier for those who are in school or who are professors or whatever. Typically, they're recent graduates of universities, but sometimes in the summer especially, we get a lot of university students who come to us and spend their summer. Many are there getting academic credit while they're with us at Jubilee, and others are not. We have some international, more Canadians than anyone else, but quite a few Europeans, and once in a while we'll have someone from another part of the world that comes as a volunteer. Then we have the refugees coming through under ordinary circumstances at the rate of 100 to 150 a year for 2 month stays and they come through these agencies from around the world. Since September 11th, as you may know, the refugee picture all over the United States has just come to an abrupt halt, and they're just now beginning to trickle in again. The U.S. pulled back all of its overseas immigration naturalization service staff and stopped the flow of refugees into the U.S., and it's only recently begun to come again. So we have word that our first families are likely to arrive very soon. They've been saying that for 2 months, but we think that's about to happen. In the meantime, we have never missed a step. We've missed the refugees terribly. Jubilee has been a very different place without refugees all around. We have been very busy doing maintenance and other things like that that have been waiting for us to find time for years. At the same time, we are taking this opportunity to explore other ways to serve people. In Central America, we have a very active program called Walk in Peace, supporting almost 100 students in college and high school in Nicaragua, a few in middle school. We have, and it does other things too. It provides some medical supplies and supports a few other programs. But we've channeled over $2 million to Central America for hurricane relief and Walk in Peace projects in the past 15 or 18 years. Increasingly, we're getting very much involved in the Middle East, and I can give you a copy of a notice that we just sent out, a newsletter announcing that that eight of us are going back to the Middle East. For me, it'll be back. I've been there six or seven times in the past few years. Be going in 3 weeks. We'll be in Jordan working on a habitat project in Jordan.
In Jordan?
Yeah.
Wow.
Right up in the corner where Jordan and Israel and Syria come together, a place called Al-Hama. This is where the old city of Gadara was, where Jesus cast the demons out of the man into the pigs over the cliff.
Yeah.
We're building at the top of that cliff.
Are you really?
My wife and I helped build the first house, just a hammer's throw. You could toss a hammer over from the project over that cliff into the Yarmouk River, right below where it flows into the Sea of Galilee. And eight of us are going back very significantly. This is a real departure from past patterns at Jubilee. Out of our concern about terrorism and the war on terrorism, the what we feel is a new kind of very ominous period in history that we've moved into, where the war, the enemy is undefined and diffused around the world, and it can justify fighting that enemy, can justify all sorts of abuses and surveillance techniques and other things against the people in our own country as we seek to protect ourselves against this amorphous enemy out there. We feel it's becoming more and more obvious that the only real way to fight terrorism is through going out and dealing with the sources of the frustration and desperation that cause people to be attracted to the likes of Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein or whoever the bad guys are. In most cases, people that the U.S. has trained initially. Anyway, in both of those cases, we train them. And now they're our chief enemies.
That's the way it works.
Yeah. The people, they would be pretty impotent, by and large, if it weren't that we help to alienate and create large groups of people who have an authentic axe to grind against the United States. If nothing else, just by pure neglect and misunderstandings between our two peoples. I don't think we are the source of all the evil in the world by any means, but we could be doing so much more in a positive direction to build bridges to large parts of the world instead of just labeling them as evil and setting them up to be through threats of force or actual use of violence against them, then to make them in fact very clearly our enemies, and so that we have reason to be afraid of them as they do of us. I think Habitat for Humanity is one obvious, perfectly designed kind of way of doing that, of building houses and villages around the world where people have terrible living conditions and need desperately that kind of help, and it's a vehicle through which I've just been talking with people here at Kansas University, the leaders of Kansas, the KU Habitat for Humanity chapter, and saying KU needs to send a delegation once the proper preparations are in place. Send a delegation from here to the Middle East to spend a week or two building somewhere. My community is going next week, or 3 weeks from now, to help blaze that trail. And I think this is a way to really promote peace in the world. And it's a way for us personally that our own backgrounds with habitats development and cross-cultural work with the refugees and other projects all come together in a very natural way for us to go to the Middle East. Now this group that is going over, I started to say just now, there's a real departure for us, and this represents a tremendous leap of faith by the Jubilee people. I'm the only one in the group that will be going of the eight who has ever been to the Middle East. The other seven are, we're at completely at their own choice, have decided that one husband or wife of each family will go while the other stays home with the kids. Five families with children. Carolyn and I don't have children at Jubilee, and there's one single man there who's 59 years old. He's never done anything like this for sure. And a younger volunteer who will be a father. He and his wife are at Jubilee, and they'll be parents, we expect, in July. So just before his is born, here he is taking off with his wife. She's the one that suggested it, and he'll be a wonderful part of the team. So seven resident partners and one volunteer going from Jubilee for 2 weeks, from May the 7th to May the 20th, and we'll get back. And in that length of time, we expect to help to build a house and to live actually among the villagers in Al-Hama, up in this northern Jordan area. This is a big departure for us, and we do it as, in some ways it's brand new, but in other ways it's vintage Jubilee, because we don't know where we're headed any more than we did 23 years ago when we started. 1984, when we started the Año de Jubileo program, program of bringing the Central American refugees up, we thought we might end up in prison if we did that. That was a very tense time, many tense confrontations with U.S. authorities. Once again, we don't really know. I mean, something terrible could happen. I had a dream 2 nights ago that we were attacked by a squad of people gunning down the members. You know, it's not out of the question. I wouldn't take these other seven back into Jordan if I didn't think, as I told them the other day, if I thought there was any more than a 1% chance at most of something really big happening to all of us, I would not risk it. By my judging and by the judging of the judgment of the people on the ground there in Jordan, the habitat people, both Jordanians and North Americans, we don't think the danger is very great. And we're watching the news carefully a few miles away in Israel-Palestine and all of that. But that's the kind of thing we are able to do as a community, that we'd have to have Ted Turner financing us if we were to try to do it as just a group of a think tank or a you know, some kind of development corporation of some type. Living as community, we can do things like I've done. I've been in jail 40 days for tax resistance back during the Nicaragua conflict between the Sandinistas and the Contras, and I felt that somebody needed to stand up and say, I'm not paying to blow any more legs off the Nicaraguan children. This is what's happening down there is not what President Reagan is saying is happening. This is a war between the rich and the poor, not between communism and freedom. And so I went to jail to help emphasize that, and spent, you know, time on national TV programs and hundreds of talks around the country, and I think together with many other such people doing similar things, we managed to bring that whole conflict to a close a bit sooner and maybe helped head off an invasion, as I think President Reagan fully intended. At one point, he was oriented toward invading Nicaragua, sending in the Marines again. So I think we're in a position to do those kinds of things because we live in community and to take those risks.
Well, what makes it possible in the sense of how do you pay the bills? I mean, you're spending a lot of money. You're supporting yourselves and doing all these other things.
Well, first of all, we choose to live as not as simply as we can. That would be overstating it. But to live very simply by U.S. standards, I would say on a modest level, certainly, we live on about $8 a day per person. Mm-hmm. Our total expenses run this year. Our W-2 form for April 15th was officially $3,000 per person. And in some ways, that's inflated because it puts a so-called fair market value on the housing, which we built most of those houses for $20,000 a piece, with several hundred dollars, a fair market value rental value of those houses, which inflates their value a great deal. But even so, say $3,000 a year, that's just about enough for two or three hamburgers a day. We're putting our kids through college. Those that don't get scholarships, we're paying medical expenses, we take vacations, we live very well, actually. We live quite well by worldwide standards, and reasonably well even by U.S. standards, with our food, housing, $15 a week. We just gave ourselves a $5 a week raise recently. Living allowance for personal telephone calls and Christmas gifts and that sort of thing.
Do you want to come on in?
So we are.
Yeah, the truth is, you can live on less.
We live on very little. Well, in turn, then, when people come there, and what we're doing is attractive enough, interesting enough to people that it attracts 2,000 to 3,000 visitors a year now to Jubilee. We have guest quarters, never charge anything for guests. We were just talking to some of the students just now who are interested in maybe taking a van load of KU students. We have a waiting line, a process in which you need to get your reservation in a year in advance because there are so many universities wanting to do that. Out of all of that flow of visitors and the 12,000 name mailing list, we get spontaneous gifts with virtually no fundraising of the usual check this box kind of arm twisting. People just spontaneously make contributions to Jubilee that are more than enough to carry on our ordinary operating expenses. Once in a great while, we have to send a few letters to a friend and say, can you lend us some money at no interest, get us through the summer or something like that. But that's rare. We've never had to slow down for lack of funds. Now, something like this trip to the Middle East 3 weeks from now, we're paying for it out of personal savings. One case, a family that has an earned income credit check that just came back, and normally they would just put that in the medical fund for our, we have a medical fund that we share, or something like that at the community. This time we all agreed to put it in the travel fund and help pay for these tickets. But the house that or houses that we pay for in the Middle East, we'll pay for those out of donations from this big mailing list of people who, tens of thousands now, who have visited Jubilee and are convinced that we're not wasting a lot of money. We live on a shoestring and stretch dollars about as far as anybody we know, and who like to be part of that. And so when we put out a call for help for victims of a hurricane, for instance, it's amazing. You know, with very little effort, we can raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think it's largely because people know that we're contributing in our own way then by living very modestly there at Jubilee. So the economics of it, the fact that we repair our own cars, we all share the same two washing machines and hang our clothes out on the line, let them
dry in the sun. We have no air conditioning except in our library to keep the books from molding there in that Georgia humidity. And we funnel some of that down into the office down below so the computers don't suffer. Our computers are all, with one exception, I think maybe two, they're all donated last generation computers. We just cut corners so much that amazingly that impresses people enough that they give even more money, and so we're able to channel a lot of money to other projects beyond Jubilee.
Well, it's pretty gratifying to believe that you're giving to a charity that's not spending at all on
fundraising
officers and fundraising.
Right.
Stuff like that.
We have no medical insurance. We have no insurance at all, except the auto insurance that's required by the state. We have no retirement plans. People, you know, are getting a grand total of $3,000 a year in goods and services, mostly goods, mostly at Jubilee, a few dollars for buying, going to a movie or something once in a while. So people are quick to put their money into that kind of thing. So we don't, and also I do a lot of speaking and our newsletters which go out and our literature, hosting college groups and all the rest. We don't even think about doing this for fundraising purposes, which in turn then makes it possible. I've spoken, I think, to probably 70 different groups, all the way from three people like we just had just now to congregations of 500, 600, 700 in one chapel service just in the past 6 weeks. And the people somehow. And it makes it much easier to get the focus on the ideas, the concepts. Those that we normally think of as religious, as well as those that are more political, or however you want to characterize it. That's very gratifying. It's fun to speak in that kind of ambiance, context, much more than if you're out just trying to get people to send money, and we promise you at least 40% of that every dollar will go overseas to do something.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way a lot of them are. Well, what's happening at Koinonia these days?
Koinonia is, for what is this, 10th time now, going through another metamorphosis. They disbanded the intentional community, the common purse.
That's what some years ago.
About 10 years ago. Yeah. And some of the people there now are talking about beginning to feel that was a mistake and wondering if they should try to reverse that. There's a kind of phoenix quality to Koinonia. It always comes back from the ashes of the last incarnation. It rises up again. And there's a very good group of people there right now. I can't claim to know them well, but I visit there when I can, and they come up to Jubilee sometime, and they are really struggling to try to make Koinonia continue as an active center for conferences to come together and discuss various issues. The environment, I think, would be a focus for them in a couple of weeks in the conference they're hosting. I spoke at a conference a year ago which had to do with discipleship and service around the world. And you know, stay tuned, because I think the people who are there now are really working hard, blacks and whites, trying to put together a new, relevant expression of the old values that have always been part of Koinonia. I'm hopeful for them. Jubilee, in many ways right now, especially in its form as a Christian community or as an intentional community with a common purse and those kinds of things, the decision-making processes, Jubilee is much more like the Koinonia of 1969 to 82, 83, and the Koinonia or 92, 93, sorry, all that period up until the Common First Group was disbanded, I think, about 92. Jubilee is much more like that was during that time, the 70s especially, when we lived there, or like it was back in the 50s and 60s when Clarence and Florence and another group of people were there in the old Koinonia farm days. Mm-hmm. You know, and starting in 1968, they reorganized as Koinonia Partners, starting in 68 as a 501c3 organization. Prior to that, they had not been a tax-exempt organization. They didn't have a board of directors and all of that. That was launched in 68 by Clarence Jordan and by Miller Fuller. They were the primary people behind that. So I think they'll probably come up with another good model before long, and they're picking up speed, seem
good
to be.
Good. Glad to hear it.
They've been through some hard times over the past 10 years. They've had two or three directors that they hired that turned out to be, they're not very experienced and astute at trying to lead such a complex organization. Mm-hmm. Or in one case, I think outright criminal, ended up in jail.
Wow.
And so they've had some really rugged times. They also had they've had a couple of high-profile experiences, high-profile because anything that negative that happens at Koinonia, you can count on the local white community, less and less these days, but certainly a few years back, say, we told you. They had a volunteer who came and sexually molested some of the children at the Child Development Center. And even though the Koinonia people acted as quickly as they became aware of it, that really caused a big uproar in the neighborhood. And it was this very nice young guy who nobody suspected this was going on, and then when they found it out, everything suddenly became big news. And they had a death. They've had several deaths, but one, the director, Jovi Anderson? No. Forgot my last name, Jovi. was drowned in a flood, in a big rainstorm flood about 10 years ago. And she was washed off the highway just down the street there from Koinonia. They've had some hard times.
They're still selling pecans and
that
kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah, they depend heavily on their mail order business. Uh-huh. They have a website and make appeals by email now, as well as mailings. I think they must have dropped back. I don't see so many snail mail mailings now as they used to, catalogs and things. Mm-hmm. Those were expensive. Maybe they're trying to do it by electronic advertising instead. I don't know. I'm not on their board. I've served three different terms on their board, and I've said that's all. served my time on the Koinonia board, so I don't know the details about the finances right now. They had to sell some of their land and a lot of their timber to get out from under a huge debt a year or two ago that was threatening to sink them. In fact, they were legally in, I think this would be the way to describe it, in receivership. The bank could have foreclosed on them, and the bank said, we don't want Koinonia, we do want the money. And they cooperated with a scheme to sell off property, and so they went out of the row crop farming business a couple of years ago and sold several hundred acres and managed to pay off their debts. Mm-hmm. That was part of that mismanagement I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. I was the director there for 3 years. It's not an easy place to direct. You have to be concurrently a business person running a $1 million-plus mail order business and diverse operation of row crop farming, at least it was when I was there, row crop farming and house building and food production. You're the mayor of an unincorporated community of several hundred people and the spokesperson for a motley crew of very independent revolutionaries, as well as local people who, with a certain element of always of some racial, the potential for racial misunderstandings between all the local black people and all of these white people from around the world. And so it's a complicated place to manage. I'm not surprised that there are problems. And yet, it's in that very stew that such creative things can happen. There are pluses as well as minuses. And I expect that some very good things will continue to happen at Cornelia.
Well, I hope so. They've sure got the history of it.
Yeah. Even if they just went out of existence tomorrow, Clarence and Florence and Martin and Mabel, their efforts and all of those of thousands of people since are well justified, I think. I'd give them a strong A+.
Yeah.
Even with a lot of F's along the way.
I should probably let you get on about your business. I think you have afternoon scheduled up, probably.
Actually, I've got some time this afternoon.
Yeah. We were trying not to schedule them too tightly because okay. He's been going and going and going, and then has to go from here to Arizona and to California. And back to Georgia, and I've forgotten where.
Oh, I'm going up to see our daughter graduate next
that's
weekend.
Right. That's right.
Just after.
And then, in less than 3 weeks, going off to Jordan.
Yeah.
So that sounds
busy enough.
I was thinking of the story they tell about the difference between the attitude at Koinonia towards the community and the attitudes in Comer's. When Don first went to Koinonia, it had not been that long before that people had still gone by and shot at them. Drill violence and danger and so forth. So they're a little cautious when they went up to Comer, and about the only thing, they were kind of strict on some things. They wanted to be real sure that there was a very good sewer system because of the refugees coming in. But the main thing they said, not going to be anybody out here in this lake going skinny dipping, is there?
That's the big concern.
That was the only thing that they really got any hostility in the early days.
The editor of the local paper, that was his. Well, by coincidence, less than a week before that, we had talked about that in one of our meetings. We said, let's be very conservative in all these things. And things like skinny dipping or anything that looks, that's out. No, let's not invite trouble. No drugs, no sex outside of marriage. We don't want to have anything like that people can point to.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Because we want to be here, if they oppose us, we want it to be over substantive issues, not these kinds of things. Well, less than a week later then, a couple of us went to the local newspaper editor, who to this day is still, he never visits Jubilee, has never set foot on there as far as I know. He's always grumpy. He's just he's a super conservative relic from the 19th century, really. Got his own gravestone already set up there waiting in the cemetery. And he lives in the oldest house, he says, in Comer. But his first comment to me was, well, it sounds like a commune to me. I hope you're not going to be doing any skinny dipping in them ponds.
Jeez.
No, sir, that's against our rules. But we've had a marvelous response overall from our neighbors all around us at Comer. That's an important thing to put in here, I guess, on this too, that after 23 years now that we've been there, Jubilee is the most popular field trip for the local schools. We are warmly welcomed at all of the local churches. I have spoken in all of the local churches. And we have close friends. As far as I'm aware, 99%. I know very few people outside of this editor and a couple of others that I think, they've never come and told me this, but they frown when I see them, that I think don't really like Jubilee. And there might be a lot that either are absolutely neutral and just don't care to learn about Jubilee, or a little on the negative side, and I don't know. But the predominant response to Jubilee is, man, this is an exciting thing, and we're proud that they're on television all the time. Nothing else at Comer's over. One guy came up to me after he saw us, I forget what it was, I think when the Kosovars came through, we were on CNN and all kinds of programs, and we had 12 TV teams were out there in the space of 2 days, had to set up press conferences, and I still remember this old farmer coming up to me with his teeth missing up on the top, and he met me at the local pizza cafe and said, he said, you know, I seen you on television just today. I seen you on television. Where was it? We don't even have a TV, so I didn't know what it was. But that's back when I went to jail. This was highly publicized, front page news, and the not only the Comer and the Athens paper, but the Atlanta paper was covering it. Reinhold Niebuhr's nephew, Richard Niebuhr's son.
Gustav.
Gustav, you know Gustav.
Yeah, I know him. Yeah.
Gustav, you know him. Wow. Gustav was the reporter that covered my trial. And Gus came out two or three times to Jubilee, and so he got a lot of publicity. Yeah. Well, the response by all of these local folks who can't figure out what the issue is, they don't know, they can't, not sure where Nicaragua is and all this kind of stuff. The response was to say, well, we don't know exactly what all that means, but they go to our Sunday school class. They're good people, you know. And I remember Mr. Dickerson, a fruit salesman in the area, told Robbie and Chu when they were over visiting with him. He says, well, you look at it. You just watch it. If somebody's really standing up for what they believe is right, the U.S. government will get after them every time. You take people like Ollie North and Don Mosley. They're two examples. That's the kind of support we got.
Boy.
not real sophisticated, but we couldn't ask for nicer neighbors.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear it. Boy, considering what the Koinonia went through with its neighbors for a long time.
That's right. Oh, we are so blessed, and we know it. So we're the ones who 5 years ago launched Habitat for Humanity locally, and all of the people who are on that board. It's self-perpetuating. We don't choose them, but they all look to Jubilee constantly as the, you know, when they have got a problem, they come to us and say, what do you think we ought to do? There's a real strong positive relationship with all of the people that are the main movers around the community. The city council, the county commissioners, and all the rest. And the Rotary Clubs, I've spoken to them twice, the local Rotary Club in the past year. So it's a golden period right now for relationships. I don't know what it'd be like next month, but right now it's good.
Well, I sure appreciate
Thank
it.
You,
Thanks
Tim.
Very much, Don.